We all know that the world suffers enormous economic inequity, hunger, deforestation, pollution, climate change, nuclear weapons, terrorism, etc. That is not even to speak about the current global financial meltdown. And to those who say that we're not really making progress, I imagine many would point, for one example, to the fact that at least we've eliminated slavery. But sadly, that would not be true. 143 years after the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was passed in 1865, and over 60 years after Article 4 of the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights banned slavery and the slave trade worldwide, there are more slaves right now than at any time in human history, 27 million. According to Kevin Bales, author of Disposable People, folks get rich by using slaves, and when they're finished with their slaves, they just throw these people away. That's the new slavery, which focuses on big profits and cheap lives. It's not about owning people in the traditional sense of the old slavery, but about controlling them completely. People become completely disposable tools for making money. During the 4 years that today's guest, Benjamin Skinner, researched modern-day slavery for his new book, A Crime So Monstrous, just out in paperback, he posed as a buyer at illegal brothels on several continents. He interviewed convicted human traffickers in a Romanian prison. He endured giardia, malaria, dengue, and a bad motorcycle accident. But Skinner says he's most haunted by his experience in a brothel in Bucharest, Romania, where he was offered a young woman with Down syndrome in exchange for a used car. Currently a fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard Kennedy School of Government, previously a special assistant to Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, Ben Skinner has written for Newsweek, the LA Times, Foreign Policy, and others. He was named one of National Geographic's Adventurers of the Year for 2008. And his first book, as I said, just recently out in paperback, is A Crime So Monstrous, Face-to-Face with Modern-Day Slavery. Welcome, Ben Skinner.
Thanks. Great to be with you, Terry.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we deal with, so I have a couple of questions to start off. One, how did you first learn about slavery? What first got you interested in slavery? And I also have read in your bios that you are descended from abolitionist stock.
The fuel began before I was born. The abolitionism in my blood began in at least as early in the 18th century, as far as we can tell, when my ancestors were Quakers, abolitionists. They stood on soapboxes in Connecticut and railed against slavery and hurt their businesses that did business in the South at the same time, but that didn't matter because they believed in something. I had other relatives that weren't Quaker, but had the same beliefs. For example, my great-great-great-grandfather fought, not a pacifist, obviously, not a Quaker, but fought with the Connecticut artillery, and very much with the idea that slavery was an abomination, and the recognition in the country then was the only way to overturn it was through bloodshed. And now, after 360,000 Union soldiers have died, after over a dozen conventions, you mentioned a couple, but over a dozen universal conventions, 300 international treaties, there are more slaves in my lifetime than at any point in human history.
Okay, and two things about that. One, just so no one quibbles or that we're not saying, we're saying something which we hope will shock, but more total slaves. How about as a percentage of population, since obviously the population in 1865 was very different?
Sure. First of all, I want to be very clear what it is that I mean when I say the word slavery.
Right, a definition.
Absolutely, because the term today is tossed around. If you look up in Merriam-Webster in the dictionary, the first definition is drudgery or toil. It's become this metaphor for undue hardship, because we assume that when we assume that once you legally abolish it, it no longer exists.
So it's good as a metaphor, but in fact.
But in fact, as a fact of life, as a matter of reality, for, as you say, up to 27 million people in the world, slaves are those forced to work, held through fraud, under threat of violence, for no pay beyond subsistence. It's a very spare definition.
And whose definition is that?
That's Kevin Bale's definition. I'm glad you asked because I don't give him enough chance to, or I don't give him enough credit. I adopted his definition he's an academic. He came up with the number 27 million originally. Subsequently, that number has been buttressed by International Labor Organization studies that found government estimates of some 12.3 million slaves in the world. That's what governments will acknowledge. Now, if you talk to NGOs in those same countries, they'll say the numbers are more than twice as high. But Kevin did a lot of the academic work that underpinned what I did when I went out, and I wanted to go out and get beyond the numbers.
Right.
And this is the critical thing. I knew that I couldn't go out and count every slave, but what I wanted to do was show what one slave's life was like, what one slave's slavery meant. And in the process of doing that, I met hundreds of slaves and survivors.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, for people that I recommend both books. Disposable People lays out, as you say, the academic, the numbers, the case and so on. A Crime So Monstrous is an investigative reporter rather than academic, going, and as I said in the intro, going to where this actually takes place, where the trades are made, and where the suffering takes place and where the survivors eke out their existence.
Right. You know, it's one thing to say, to lay out that definition, to talk about the numbers. It's another thing when I go, as you mentioned, into this underground brothel in Bucharest and I'm offered a young woman for sale who has a visible effect of Down syndrome. One of her arms was covered in slashes where I can only assume she was trying to escape daily rape the only way that she knew how. And that young woman was offered to me in trade for a used car.
And by the way, this was a Romanian used car, wasn't it?
This was a Romanian used car. And it's something that I knew because I'd been working with various elements in the underworld for a couple of weeks before I went into that brothel. And I knew that I could get that car for about 1,500 euros. Now, while that may sound like a very low price for human life, consider that 5 hours from where I live in New York, 5 hours from where I live, that's a 3-hour flight down to Port-au-Prince, Haiti, an hour from the airport, I was able to negotiate for a 10-year-old girl for domestic and sexual slavery, and the asking price was $50.
Now, I just want to say that before we went on the air, you asked me, how much do you think you could get a 10-year-old girl for cleaning, cooking, permanent possession, right? And sexual favors. And I said
$7,500.
And you said, well, they asked for 100, but you talked them down to 50.
You're right. I'm glad you gave me the chance to correct. They asked for 100, talked them down to 50. Now, to put that in context, going back to the time when my abolitionist ancestors were on their soapbox, you could buy in broad daylight in 1850 a healthy grown male for the equivalent of about $40,000.
Now, I want listeners to hear that. That actually, I mean, when I first read those numbers, I was shocked that in fact it was a sizable investment to get a good worker in the mid 1800s.
And this is not to diminish the horrors that those workers would face in slavery. This is not to diminish their dehumanization one bit. It was an abomination then as it is today. But it is to say that in the mid 19th century, masters would view their slaves as an investment, one way or the other. And, you know, just as people beat up their Mercedes when they buy them today, then oftentimes they would beat up their slaves. But here's the thing. When a slave costs $50 on the street in broad daylight in Port-au-Prince, and by the way, this was in a decent neighborhood. Everybody knew where these men were and what they did. When a slave costs $50, these people are, to go back to Kevin's term, eminently disposable in the eyes of their masters.
You're in L.A. today for an event. Would you like to mention what that is?
Absolutely. This evening, I'm speaking at the Beverly Hills Country Club alongside a survivor of slavery and Julia Ormond, the actress who's been a stalwart abolitionist since she first heard about the issue about a decade ago. And it's a fundraiser for an organization called CAST, which stands for the Coalition Against Slavery and Trafficking LA, on the web at castla.org.
Okay, so that's castla, one word, .org.
And please go, RSVP, come. It'll be a great event, and it's supporting the organization that, in my eyes, is the best and most mature regional organization fighting slavery here in the United States. And okay. this is an issue that we need to talk about, is slavery in the United States, because it's not just in places like Romania and Haiti.
Let's go to that right now, okay. Because that was one of my questions. When we say 27 million and we mention places like Haiti and Romania, and if my reading is correct, the biggest concentrations are of slave trade, I guess, Southeast Asia and portions of Latin America?
South Asia in particular.
South Asia.
South Asia in particular. If you were to plot slaves on a map, the biggest number of pins you'd have to stick would be in India, followed by Pakistan, Nepal, Bhutan, that whole area. There are more in India alone, there are arguably more slaves than the rest of the world combined. And yet, if you look at international efforts, if you look at American pressure, India is largely let off the hook, because these are seen in the eyes of Indian federal officials as, and they claim, we have no slaves. They say, these are just poor people. These are the Dalit. These exploitive labor practices, if you're lucky, you'll get that term out of them, are a byproduct of poverty. Let me be clear. The end of slavery cannot wait for the end of poverty. And when we're talking about slavery in India, what I'm talking about largely is generational debt bondage, people whose grandparents took a debt.
Okay, let me just say, we'll get back to the question of slavery in America, but this is important. Remember when we talked a few moments ago about the definition, and that definition was forced to work against their will, with no escape.
Held through fraud. Under threat of violence for no pay beyond subsistence. These are people that cannot walk away.
So a huge percentage of them, we'll talk in a moment about sex trafficking, which gets its own sort of category. But a huge number of them are in this sort of debt bondage. Describe that.
Absolutely. Okay. I'll give you an example of an individual that I found, I stumbled upon in a quarry, in northern India. And this fellow had been enslaved his entire life. He had assumed that slavery at birth. His grandparents, his grandfather, in fact, had taken a debt of 62 cents. And three generations and three slave masters later, the principal had not been paid off one bit. The family was illiterate, innumerate. They didn't keep the books. And three generations and three slave masters later, this fellow, who I call Ganu, he asked me to protect his identity, was still forced to work, held through fraud under threat of violence for no pay beyond subsistence. Since he was a child, this is what he did. This is what he and his family and his children did. They took, along with the rest of the enslaved villagers, huge rocks out of the earth, and they pummeled those rocks into gravel for the subgrade of India's infrastructure, which is, you know, the gleaming pride of the Indian elites. And they further pulverized that gravel into sand, silica sand for glass. There's only one way that you turn a profit off of handmade sand, and that's through slavery.
Very good. Okay, so that's – and this happens his was because of a debt from generations ago. Another way it happens is you go into a poverty-stricken village. You say, we need workers in the mines, whatever sort of mines they are.
Sure.
Charcoal briquettes, I know, are one of those.
Where I was 24 hours ago in Brazil, it's a massive problem in the north where workers – and here's the thing. Here's what's tricky about this. In many cases, these workers – want to work. What they don't want is to be forced to work under threat of violence, beaten regularly, having the women in their lives raped as a means of humiliating them, and then not being paid anything.
And one of the ways is that you pick them up in a rural village away from the mines, you offer them something, you take them to the mines.
Yeah.
And when they arrive, they have a debt for that transportation, which is greater than anything they will ever be able to repay.
Absolutely. And if they try to leave, there are men with guns. That's slavery.
Okay.
And in the case of, going back to Haiti for a second, in the case of that young girl, that is a form of slavery that you see in other parts of the world, but you see it in the Western Hemisphere, in the greatest concentration, the greatest numbers in Haiti. According to UNICEF, there are some 300,000 child slaves in Haiti.
Does that mean in Haiti or?
That means
originating in Haiti.
That means in Haiti. That means in Haiti. Within Haitian borders, there
are. So with all the poverty in Haiti, there are people who still can afford 300,000 slaves.
Well, here's the thing. If they're paying $50, then.
That's
then,
right.
Although, the remarkable thing, I went back last summer with Dan Harris of ABC Nightline, and he said, he was pretty incredulous of my claim. And in fact, it took him 10 hours from ABC offices in Manhattan. But in those 10 hours, by the end of those 10 hours, he negotiated not with one, but three traffickers who'd offered him three separate girls. And, as he put it, the remarkable thing is not that you can get a child for 50, it's that you can get a child for free. And it, because when you go up into these villages, you see such desperation on the parts of the parents. And I did this after that negotiation on the street. I first of all, want to make this clear. I never paid for human life. And I never would pay for human life. I talked to too many individuals who run trafficking shelters, who help slaves become survivors, who implored me. They said, do not pay for human life. You will be giving rise to a trade in human misery. And as a journalist, you'll be projecting to the world that this is the way that you end the problem. If you were to buy all 300,000 slaves, child slaves in Haiti, the next year you'd have 600,000.
Now, first, when you told me that again off air, my brain said, wait a minute, why more? But, of course, what you've said is, if you were to buy the 300,000 slaves in Haiti in one fell swoop or 3 months or something, you would then say, hey, business is good.
Right.
And so people would grab more slaves.
Right. And you're talking about introducing hard currency in many cases into a transaction that hasn't involved hard currency in the past. You're massively incentivizing a trade in human
misery. One of the ways that people attempt to deal with this, I think, is called redemptions, is people who will buy slaves their freedom.
Yeah.
What's the take on that? I mean, who's doing it? And what's your analysis of it?
My analysis, and this is on the basis of 3 months spent in southern Sudan, in southern and northern Sudan, but 2 months in southern Sudan in particular, where there was a one particular evangelical group based in Switzerland, run by organized by an American, who was going in, and first of all, they were raising cash around the states. They'd go to, a Sunday school in Colorado or a second grade class in Colorado and talk about slavery, and they'd say, bring us your lunch money, and if you can get us $50, we will buy a slave's freedom. It was a very effective sales pitch. They managed to raise over $3 million by my calculations over the course of the 1990s. And what they in theory were doing was giving money to retrievers, quote unquote, who would go to the north and through whatever means necessary secure the slaves' freedom and bring them back down to the south. This is slavery in the context of the Sudanese civil war was used as a weapon of war by the north, where the northern militias would go and raid southern villages, and in many cases they would kill the men and they would take the women and children as slaves, and a weapon of genocide. That much is not questioned. There's no question that slavery was going on, that these slave raids were going on. What I found is that redemption on the ground was enormously problematic. There was scant oversight. They were giving over literally duffel bags full of cash to factions within the rebels that were resisting an ongoing peace process at that point. And what they risked doing, whether through recklessness or through intent, was to essentially become angels of destruction at a time when a negotiated peace was just beginning to take hold. Thankfully, at this point, they've scaled the redemptions back.
So let me just make clear. So what was happening was collecting money in the states to free slaves. And in fact, funding
a rebel movement.
A rebel movement in a war, and your point of view, potentially prolonging
the war.
Yeah, yeah.
And thankfully, what happened in the end was the death of John Garang, who was the rebel leader, meant that a different faction, the faction, in fact, that this group was supporting, came to be powerful. It was, from my perspective, lucky that there wasn't any internecine fighting between the rebel factions. But I'll tell you what, from my perspective, from what I could see, what was going on there was largely fraudulent. I went back in and I talked to the rebel officials. I said, well, what do you do with this money? And they said, well, we use this for the benefit of the people. Which begs the question, well, I thought this was being used to buy back slaves. I don't get it.
Yeah.
And they said, well, you know, the clothes, uniforms. They didn't actually say arms. They didn't say arms. But they said, you know, all sorts of things that we need hard currency for. This was their way of getting currency. I don't blame the rebels. Listen, if I was in a similar situation, I'd probably do the same thing. The most important point is this, however. The most important point is not the sideshow that this caused, but it's that by the merest estimates, there are still some 12,000 slaves held in brutal bondage in the north of Sudan, and the government has not arrested, has not prosecuted one slave raider, one slave trader, one slave master. And as long as that continues to be the situation, the government of Sudan is in gross violation of international law.
Okay. Let's go back to that question. I'm speaking with Ben Skinner, author of A Crime So Monstrous. He spent 4 years kind of as an investigative reporter in the world, in the underbelly of globalization, as Hillary Clinton has called it, in the world of slave traders, slaves, and survivors of slavery. Let's go back to a point, one of the points we left hanging, which is the distinction between sexual trafficking, sexual slavery, and this other kind of just labor. What does that distinction, how does that distinction show up, and how does it matter?
Well, it's important, I think, to take the type of slavery out of it when we're talking about slavery. When we're defining slavery, fundamentally, at its core, it's the same in each and every circumstance. We're talking about people forced to work, held through fraud, under threat of violence, for no pay beyond subsistence. If we're talking about forced commercial sexual slavery, in other words, forced prostitution, we are talking about there's an added element of humiliation, of shame, because essentially what we're talking about is rape. And in many parts of the world, in many traditional societies, if a woman is raped, it's her fault. And so when women are liberated and try to go back to the villages where they come from, that's it. They will never lead a normal life again. And I think it's safe to say in the United States even, which we assume is a much more welcoming, tolerant society, women who have been in prostitution, regardless of whether it's forced or not, have a difficult time finding normal work, leading a normal life afterwards. So this isn't, you know, there is a school of thought that sexual slavery is somehow worse than other forms of slavery. I actually don't buy that. I think that all slavery is monstrous, and no one slave's emancipation should wait for that of another. But at the same time, if some people are moved to fight sexual slavery and fight sexual trafficking at the exclusion of other forms of slavery, God bless them. As long as they're fighting slavery, and
right,
at the end of the day,
we've got about really about 2.5 minutes left. So I want you to say very quickly what the situation is in America, very quickly, and then spend the rest of that time telling people what they can do.
Sure. If we've been talking for about half an hour here, on average, one more person will have been trafficked into the United States into slavery. We're talking about 14,000 to 17,000 per year are trafficked into the U.S., forced to work, under threat of violence for no pay beyond subsistence within U.S. borders. One great way of getting involved in this fight, particularly right here in L.A., is by supporting Cast L.A. Cast L.A. has the oldest trafficking shelter in the country for trafficked women. It has terrific programs that help victims not only of sexual trafficking but of all forms of trafficking. It's an incredibly good, mature organization. On the web, castla.org. Also getting involved with Free the Slaves.
And for those of you who tuned in and haven't heard that, Ben Skinner will be appearing at a fundraiser for castla.org.
.org tonight.
.org tonight, and you can still get in touch with them and still go, and there will be a survivor of slavery there.
There'll be a survivor of slavery who's receiving an award. Julia Ormond, the actress, will be receiving an award. It'll be a great cast of characters, and it should be a great night for abolition.
Right. Okay. So, and the number in America is something like 50,000?
That's the best estimate. Of course, these slaves don't stand in line, raise their hand, and wait for the census to be taken.
Right.
But very briefly, in the few moments that we have left, I supporting Free the Slaves at freetheslaves.net, Cast LA at castla.org, picking up the book and talking about it. You can read about it more at crimesomonstrous.com, and a quarter of my royalties go to Free the Slaves. And beyond that, in this year in particular, this is the time when Barack Obama is setting his foreign policy agenda. He needs to hear from all of us that slavery, the abolition of slavery, the real abolition of slavery, needs to be a part of his legacy.
Very good. So again, the book is A Crime So Monstrous. Ben Skinner will be appearing tonight, and for that you go to castla.org to learn more. The websites to learn more about the issue are acrimesomonstrous.com and freetheslaves.net.